since creation is a unique event, we don't know what to expect or what to say about a creative act, do we? Any more than the first time you walk up to a billiard table, you don't have any idea that this is a game, what the balls are there for, that you're supposed to use the stick to hit one of the particular balls and so forth. You have no way of knowing what to expect the first time around. That is, you can only argue in terms of pattern, you can only argue in terms of design once you have numerous instances of design. And so as Hume says, the regularity of sequence that we see and call design in this world is about kinds or classes of events. But that regularity of sequence cannot be applied to a singular occurrence like the origin of the entire universe. Since creation is a unique event, there is no pattern, that have been experienced previously for this alleged causal sequence between the divine will and then the effect of a orderly universe that follows. And this too undermines, you see, the evidential approach. Says, well, look, by analogy we can argue from this to that. Hume says, you don't have any analogies for creation. That only happened once. So you can't say what a creative fiat would bring about. You can't explain then the things in this world by analogy to all the little patterns you see in this world. Secondly, he said the argument from analogy is very weak. If the author of this world is analogous to this world, then why should we assume that the author of this world is intelligent at all? Hume said when you look at this world, it seems to be more like a vegetative process than a machine. And this is fascinating. It's a matter of literary analysis. But Hume recognized that the argument of the evidentialist like Butler, the argument of the Christian apologist, always likens the world to mechanical metaphors. And in choosing that as their metaphor, they have begged the question. Well, of course, if the world is a machine, then there must be a designer of the machine. But there are other things in this world, in fact, far more common do we experience in this world, orderly things that are not machines at all. What are they? Plants. Plants don't have intelligence. They have an inner dynamism of some sort, but they don't have intelligence. And so Hume said, the argument from analogy is weak. It may be that the cause of this world is not an intelligence like the maker of a machine, but like a plant, a vegetative process. Moreover, according to Hume, the argument from design doesn't prove that there's only one designer. Let's say we go down to the ocean and we see some wonderful ocean liner that exists there that somebody has made. Now, no one's going to say that ocean liner just came about by chance. But now stop and ask yourself, must you say necessarily there was only one designer of the ocean liner? Of course not. In fact, you probably know the way these things happen. There are many people who work together. One person designs this, another that, and they bring it together. So Hume said, you certainly, by design, don't prove that there's only one designer. There may be many designers. Moreover, the argument from design doesn't prove that it's a perfect designer. Why is that? Well, let's say that I have a mechanic who's working on my car, and he does it just right. He's got the design down. Or a man who's making my car in the first place, not just fixing it. In human experience, is it usually the case that the first time around, the first time you try to repair a car, the first time you try to make a car, you get it right perfectly from the scratch? No. People learn by trial and error, don't they? The most intelligent designers, the most successful, whether they are artists or makers of machines and so forth, have a lot of experience of failure. Hume said, by looking at this world, even if you thought it was a perfect world, you could not conclude, therefore, that the designer of this world was perfect. The designer of this world may have had many shots at universes that didn't work at all. You know, flubbed up here, flubbed up there, but finally got it right. So the argument from design doesn't prove a personal designer, it could be a vegetative process, doesn't prove there's only one designer, doesn't even prove that it's a perfect one designer. But now Hume really makes the argument tougher. He says, if we're going to argue to the attributes of God from the attributes of the universe, does the order of violence, pain, and death in this universe prove then a sadistic designer? God designed the universe, but Hume said, you've got to take everything into account. This universe is just not all the happy things like flowers and watches that you evidentialists like to talk about. This universe includes other things like viciousness and violence and bloodshed and bruising and death and pain. And so if that too has got to be projected back into the designer of this wondrous order, then apparently we've got a sadistic designer of the universe, not a moral designer of the universe. The deformities and the inconveniences that we see in this universe don't suggest an all-competent architect of the universe. As Hume liked to say, if you had an architect and a builder who were putting a house together for you, and you came to see it and you found that the stairways don't go to where they're supposed to, they don't make connections, people fall through when they walk on them and so forth, said you wouldn't be real impressed with the architect, you would dismiss him immediately. Hume said, if you want to argue from design, I want to know why we don't dismiss the architect of all this pain round about us. That is a very gripping argument emotionally. And you'll find if you deal with people who have a lot of bitterness or pain or sorrow in their life, they'll latch onto this and say, exactly, I've been angry with God all along. So even if there is a designer, what kind of designer is he that would put us through such pain? But Hume pushes one step further. Because you could say, okay, there is a designer of the universe. Of course, it's not an omnicompetent, perfect designer of the universe. It's a sadistic, not a moral and perfect designer of the universe. But Hume goes further and he says, and logically, it cannot be the Christian God that's the designer of this universe. And that from what we call the problem of evil. According to Christian theology, God is all-powerful. And secondly, God is all good. Now, if in this universe we find all these deformities, inconveniences, bloodshed, pain, sorrow, death, then obviously this universe is not all good, is it? But if God is all powerful, then he is able to prevent evil. And if God is all good, he wouldn't want this evil that we find. Therefore, the fact that we find evil, pain, sorrow, death in the universe proves that God is either not all good or not all powerful, in which case this can't be the Christian God who is both all good and all powerful. Now are you beginning to get a sense for why it's said that in the debate between Butler and the deist, it's Hume who won? Because both the deist and the evangelicals, you see, Hume says, don't prove anything by their design argument that comes anywhere close to Christian theology. Now, Hume added some material to his dialogues about natural religion just before his death. And I want you to get two things here that he says. According to Hume, right before his death, the bottom line of natural theology is this. That is, a person who follows the line of evidential apologetics, the natural theologian, at best, his conclusion will be the cause or causes of order in the universe probably bear some remote analogy to human intelligence. I mean, that is laughable in itself when you think about the incredible claims that are made in our day by evidential apologetics for what they can prove. Hume, after doing this strict philosophical analysis, says, when all is said and done, their argument comes down to only this. The cause or causes, plural, the cause or causes of order in the universe probably bear some remote, note, remote analogy to human intelligence. But that's as far as you can go from the evidence. And notice that this conclusion is ambiguous. It's an imperfect analogy. You cannot extend it to make God greater than just a little bit more human intelligence. And he says this argument has no practical effect on life. Now listen closely. Hume says, quote, "A person seasoned with a just sense of the imperfections of natural reason will fly to revealed truth with the greatest avidity." Basically, he's saying the only option you really have if you want to be a Christian is revealed religion. Natural religion is only going to give you a cause or causes which are in some remote way analogous to human intelligence. So revealed religion is the only option, but of course you know what Hume thinks of revealed religion. It's just nothing but superstition. According to him, philosophical skepticism is the first and most essential step towards being a sound, believing Christian. I say that again. Philosophical skepticism is, quote, "the first and most essential step towards being a sound, believing Christian." Hume is, if you will, frightening the pigeons back into the bush. He says, you want to be a Christian? Then the best way is to be a philosophical skeptic, because then you'll see that the only thing you have is to run to revealed religion, which of course is nothing but superstition, but the sound Christian doesn't believe in natural theology. The only sound Christian holds to revealed religion. And though I don't evaluate it the same way Hume does, I happen to agree with that. I think the options are revealed religion or skepticism. Hume liked the skepticism part. I would argue we should take the revealed religion part. Okay, so on the one hand, he says natural theology gives us only a remote analogy to human intelligence. But then there was a second thing that he wanted to say. He said religious skepticism can't be adequate either. Ah, this is interesting. He says the skeptic, the religious skeptic, can't make his point either. In fact, and now I quote him, "the beauty and fitness of final causes is a way of speaking of design or order, the beauty and fitness of design strike us with such irresistible force that all objections appear, what I believe they really are, mere cavils and sophisms." Interesting. He says that the argument from design has such an irresistible force that those who object to it are only engaging in sophisms. But of course, for him, he's already mitigated what the conclusion of the argument from design is. That is just that there's some remote analogy to human intelligence in the world. He goes, you can't deny that. There is some remote analogy to human intelligence in the world. So anybody who wants to fight against that is just engaged. It's just You know, he's playing games philosophically. That's just cavils and sophisms. And so I quote him again. Hume says, "The atheist, who I assert is only nominally so and can never possibly be in earnest." According to Hume, no atheist can be earnest. He can only be an atheist in name, only nominally so. That too fascinates Dr. Bonson, because that's what I say in my apologetic. There are no sincere atheists, only people who call themselves atheists. They use the name, but they aren't really atheists. Hume said that as well. Hume said that you can't fully be an atheist because you have to grant there's some remote analogy to intelligence. Of course, it may be a plurality of vegetative processes we're talking about, but even that is a remote analogy to human intelligence. So he says, on the one hand, the Christian can't claim very much for natural theology. In fact, he'll become a skeptic and be forced to reveal religion. He can't go very far with this. All you get is this remote analogy. But on the other hand, he says you can't be an atheist in sincerity because there is a remote analogy. And besides, nobody can, as he says, quote, persevere in total skepticism. Atheists must act as though there is a mind, an intelligence, or rationality to the universe. Act as though. You've got to stress that. Haven't proven that, but atheists cannot persevere in total skepticism. They must act as though there is a mind or order or rationality, because there's some remote analogy to human intelligence out there. How does Hume know that? Well, let's say the atheist and the evangelical have been debating with each other all night long, and they're upstairs, you know, in the study doing this. When they go home, you'll notice Hume says they both take the stairways down. The atheist doesn't walk out the window, because he knows there's an order to this universe. You've got to live in this universe. You've got to act as though there's rationality, even though you can't prove that or so. And so on the one hand, you have Christians who can't prove very much at all, a remote intelligence, maybe a vegetative process even. But on the other hand, the atheist can't deny that there is a remote intelligence, and he must act as though it's there. And so, according to Hume, both the religious dogmatist and the atheist must admit that there are difficulties in their own positions. Nobody wins finally in the debate between religious dogma and atheism. The theist allows that the original intelligence is very different from human intelligence. You talk to any godly man who believes, you know, as a Christian, and if you say, but the difference between God and man is infinitely great, he's going to say, that's right. There is an analogy between God and man and their intelligence, but it's a very distant analogy because God is so great. Hume says, so the original intelligence of the atheist is very different from human intelligence. Did I say the original intelligence of the atheist? I should have said theist. Pardon me. The original intelligence promoted by the theist is very different from human intelligence. And on the other hand, the atheist has to allow that the original principle of order bears a remote analogy to human intelligence. And therefore, according to Hume, the argument between the religious man and the atheist comes down to merely a matter of degree of similarity or difference between the original order and human intelligence. Every atheist has got to grant there is some remote analogy, but he would say it's really, really remote. But there's some. The religious person wants to say there is some, so there's got to be intelligence. And I quote him, "It seems evident that the dispute between the skeptics and dogmatists is entirely verbal. The skeptic, from habit, caprice, or inclination, insists most on the difficulties in the argument. The dogmatist, for like reasons, on the necessity of the argument. Okay? So what has evidentialism given us? One, it hasn't given us Christianity. And the theism that it gives us is really, it's going to have to grant to the atheist that it hasn't made its point. And the difference between the theist and the atheist will be a verbal difference. One will emphasize the difference between the original order and human intelligence, and the other will stress how they are similar. One looks at the difficulties, the other looks at the necessity of the argument, but they really are saying the same thing. Hume likened it to this. People may argue about how beautiful Cleopatra was. But when they argue, they're not really differing over any particular fact. They're only differing about how they talk about that fact. You couldn't ever, I mean, what if somebody said Cleopatra was really, really beautiful? Somebody says, well, she was beautiful. And the other person says, no, really, really beautiful. No, she was beautiful, and that's enough to say that. And they go back and forth. Wouldn't you come to the conclusion this is something subjective? One person wants to put an emphasis on she didn't really have a perfect nose, but she was a beautiful woman. The other person, not worried about the imperfect nose, says, boy, she was really a knockout. Okay, this, I hope, helps you to see. Hume says the atheist and the theist. The theist is not a Christian, mind you. That's been knocked out of the ballpark. But the theist that is left and the atheist, they're just debating over how beautiful God is. How remote is the analogy to human intelligence? And so the differences between theism and atheism reduce to subjective personal inclination. Subjective personal inclination. That's important for us as Christians and budding apologists to pay attention to, that he believed the real difference between the rational theist and the rational atheist is just a matter of subjective inclination. One says, hey, the nose is not important to the question of beauty, and the other says, no, that just makes it only a little bit beautiful. That is, they have a different subjective approach, but they're really looking at the same nose here on Cleopatra's face. They're really looking at the same evidence. One says, hey, that's remote to human intelligence. The other says, hey, but it is intelligence. Oh, but it's remote. Oh, but it isn't. Don't worry about that. It's just, you know, your subjective inclination here. That I want you to note. But there's another thing. What is it that causality in science reduces to? Human inclination. The disposition or habit of drawing a connection between events. And so Hume's empiricism, sports fans, reduces science to psychology and religion to psychology. Science is based on a psychological edifice, and the difference between religious and irreligious people is again a psychological matter of inclination. So let's get in the helicopter and get above all these details and look back now at the pattern of the forest. How would you say empiricism's doing as a philosophy? Empiricism reduces everything to subjectivism. One last thing about Hume and then we'll break for today. In terms of his religious convictions, is the doctrine of a future state, the doctrine of life after death, necessary to human morals? See, the deist said, if you don't believe in a judgment according to works after this life, then you destroy ethics or morals among men. Now, from what I told you about Hume's life, do you think he's going to be sympathetic to that argument? Hume is angry. And his anger, his hostility, is in the realm of ethics, remember. He couldn't teach at Edinburgh moral philosophy. And at the end of his life, He thought the doctrine of an afterlife was ridiculous, the trash can of the ages, having to be created over and over again. So Hume thought that morals had nothing to do with an afterlife. Religion has no influence, or should have no influence, on conduct. Religion should have no influence on conduct. And he added, and whenever it does influence conduct, it does so for evil. Religion should not be connected to morality, to conduct. And when somebody tries to draw that connection, it always has evil results. Well, as Christians, you probably don't appreciate Hume saying that. We may want to, you know, kind of get up on our high horse and want to argue with this guy about this, right? Well, that's fine. I oppose him too, but I want you to realize I don't have to come up with anything to oppose him. You know why? Because Hume has already handed me the rope by which I can hang what he just said. Hume hangs himself. He says religion ought not to have an influence on ethics. Isn't that an ethical claim? That it's wrong to bring ethics into connection with religion? That religion, when it does touch upon conduct, does so for evil? Doesn't that assume there is some absolute objective thing known as evil? But what have we just seen about empiricism? It reduces everything to psychology, doesn't it? And though we don't have time today to finish the lecture on Hume, when we come back and look at his ethical theory, you'll see that his ethical theory is just empirical psychology. Well, if you're only an empirical psychologist, how can you call anything evil in an objective, absolute sense? And how can you say that religion ought not, then, to have anything to do with ethics? I want you to pick up some apologetics as we're going through here. This is a very important apologetical observation. Hume refutes Hume. So when he stands up and says all these things against Christianity, what do I have to worry? I mean, it's just like spitting into the wind.